Broadcasting live from the Wake Forest Business Radio X studios in North Carolina, it's time for Metro Raleigh Business Radio, where business leaders in Raleigh come to tell their stories.
Hello, happy Monday. This is Anne Ravel-Petcher, your host for Metro Raleigh Business Radio, here today in the studio in beautiful Wake Forest, North Carolina, with Cal Hackman, my co-host. Hey, Cal.
Hey, Anne. How are you?
Welcome back from the weekend.
Thank you.
Did you have a good one?
A great one.
Yeah, I know. I spent mine on the beach. It was such a beautiful weekend. And we have Angie Hand here producing the show for us today. Hello, Angie.
Hello.
Great to have you here. So our show today is really, really interesting. We have two companies here in the studio that are doing very, very, very different things, but both shaking it up in a very big way. I want to introduce Miles Wright, who is the CEO of Xanify. Hi.
Hey, Anne. Good to be here.
It's so great to see you again. It's been forever.
It feels like it.
I cannot wait to catch up with what's going on with you guys. And Jeffrey Slater. Jeffrey is the Director of Global Marketing for Nomacork. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
I'm really good. It's good to have you here.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So we're actually going to start today by talking to Nomacork a little bit about what they're doing up in Zebulon. So tell the studio audience for us, as well as the entire audience all over the world, tell us about what Nomacork is and does.
Sure. Well, just to take it all the way back, the business was founded as an idea by a Belgian entrepreneur named Gert Noël. Hmm. And he was in the foam manufacturing in Belgium many, many years ago and had two sons. And one of his sons came to North Carolina and actually started Nomeco, which was the original parent company that Nomacork actually came from. But the interesting thing was that Gert was a wine lover, and he was always troubled by the idea that wine had cork taint, and up to 10% of the bottles would be ruined because natural cork has something called TCA in it that can actually give you that sort of damp basement, wet newspaper kind of, you know, something's wrong.
Yep, right.
And he just always had this idea that there was a way of fixing that problem through the technology that he knew and could do, but he never, ever got to it, and unfortunately passed before he saw the evolution of this business in the way that it is today. But his son, Mark Noël, who started Nomeco, as I said, originally in Connecticut and came down to North Carolina. But he just felt like there was a way of doing this. So he, while one business was focused on structural foam for home furnishing and insulation and other businesses, he took a sort of a skunk work small group of a few people aside and set up this other business to try and figure out how to create this product that looked like a cork. And so we are now about 15 years into the experiment. We will be selling our 20 billionth cork with
a
B.
Wow, cool.
You know, we sell about 2.5 billion corks each year.
Wow.
And roughly speaking, about 40% of all wine bottled in the United States is closed with Nomacork.
I was just going to ask you, what's that percentage? So it's 40% of the U.S.
Yes, 40% of the U.S. market, and about 13% on a global basis.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in some markets, for example, in France, we close about one out of every four bottles of wine bottled in country.
Wow.
So we have a huge footprint. And it is because we have a disruptive technology that solved a problem. You know, I'm a marketing guy.
certainly are.
And I think about marketing as problem solving and products as problem solving. And the problem we solved was able to be consistent, able to eliminate TCA, mm-hmm. and make a product that was easy to get out of the bottle.
Now, if I remember correctly, I think that these first came out when I was living in Seattle. So there was a big discussion about how this was better for the environment than tearing down all the cork trees in the world. Is that part of the discussion? How does environmentalism fit into your mission?
Yeah, there's a lot of bad information all over the place.
Sure.
So let me just start with there. I think it's a confusing issue. And if you start with a product like a bottle of wine and think about things like carbon footprint, 99% of the carbon-related issues are in the bottle and the water and the transportation.
Sure.
And the closure is what we call the cork, is a tiny, tiny percentage of that issue. But as a company, we take the environment very seriously and are a lean Six Sigma manufacturing organization.
Oh, that's cool.
So we're always looking to take waste and inefficiency out, mm-hmm. cost out,
cool.
and always looking for ways of finding the ability to recycle. So, for example, in the state of Texas, where we have a partner, Specs, a big retailer of wine, we have a closed-loop system where consumers buy the wine there, they bring the closures back to the store, we have somebody who picks it up from the store, and then they take that and repurpose that material into other markets. So they actually process those polymers and bring them back to second life for other products. And that's a model that we're trying to expand in other cities and other places. We're working in California and in Washington. We have programs in Europe that we're working on, too. So it's a very important issue for us.
That's really cool. So there are things to do with them other than make wreaths.
Yes, indeed.
We always make wreaths out of our wine corks.
Yeah, there's actually quite a lot of things that can be done with them. But, you know, we want to be responsible citizens.
Uh-huh.
We take the larger community as part of who we are. And if we're doing a good job, we have to be responsible for those products and things that we manufacture. And mm-hmm. I like to say we are not perfect, but we are on a journey, and we are getting better and better. And in fact, now this is the third year, we're creating a corporate social responsibility document that is sort of like an annual report, third-party audited, that shows how much material we used year over year, water, electric, cardboard.
Excellent.
And it highlights for us things we're doing well and things we need to improve. It even talks to the issue of hours of community service as a company that we've donated, and all sorts of things that we're involved in. Nomacork is very actively involved in the Frankie Lemon School and for developmentally disabled children.
Is
and
that here in Raleigh?
In Raleigh, mm-hmm. yes, and it's been here for quite some time. So we have quite a lot of involvement there, but Food Bank and Boys Club and lots of other organizations.
That's great. Tell us about your global footprint and how you market globally.
Well, we don't really talk to consumers. We speak to the trade. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what we do is focused on what we call oxygen management. Most people don't realize it, but when you bottle wine, the winemaking process continues after it's bottled.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's on a store shelf or in a cellar, in a restaurant somewhere.
Which is why wine ages.
Exactly. And what a Nomacork is like a very sophisticated engineered air filter that allows a winemaker to make the wine exactly as they intend it to be. So if they want that to have a little bit of oxygen and it's going to get consumed in 6 months, there's a closure for that. If it's going to sit for 5 years and they want it to develop very slowly with a very small amount of oxygen over a longer period of time, we have a closure for that. So we create closures that are tools for winemakers so that they
That's
can make wine, because there's different types of grapes,
sure.
there's different types of styles of winemaking, there's different blends, different channels for distribution. A lot of issues go into it.
I've mostly seen Nomacorks in still wine, if you will. Can you use it in a champagne kind of a wine?
So right now we are only in still wine. We are looking at and working on some technologies around other possible markets like sparkling wines, champagne, cava, prosecco, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been very focused on the still wine market since the beginning. And there's some requirements that are a little bit different, but it's not outside of our reach. It's really, a sort of adjacent technology to what we do.
Okay.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will be interested in knowing, how did you end up in Zebulon?
Well, we ended up in Zebulon because Mark Noel, when he first came from Connecticut, it moved to Connecticut, and his manufacturing was there. As I understand the story, he came down to North Carolina and really loved the area and was looking for a place to be able to develop the Nomaco business and expand it, and found some property in Zebulon, the friendly town of Zebulon. That's the sign. The town of friendly people.
And
which is really, really kind of neat.
Yeah.
So that's how we ended up there. We used to... we like to kid that it is really the wine center of the world. But for us, it became very convenient because we were able to ship closures to Europe and we were able to sell to California, so we were well positioned.
Right.
Today, we have manufacturing in other places. So we have a facility in Belgium, that serves the wine industry in Europe. We also have manufacturing partnerships and other types of manufacturing, for example, in China, where we do printing, but we don't make the closure there, and in Argentina, where our business is growing, and we have some connections to new ways of being able to manufacture there that we're working on. So it's really an expanding and growing business, but Zebulon is the center.
You have a very interesting marketing background. Tell us a little bit about how you got started. I mean, I think the first that I heard of you had something to do with brownies.
It did indeed. So in around 1975, my wife...
When you were 12.
When I was 12. My wife, at the time my girlfriend, was making brownies in the city of Philadelphia under the brand name of Rachel's Brownies. Mm-hmm. And she started selling them in specialty stores. At the time I was in graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania. And at some point, maybe about 8, 9 months, 10 months later, I started helping her a little bit with the business, but it was really her baby, her product. But together, we built the business from around 1978 on till 1989. And we grew it from a small bakery of just the two of us to a facility with about 100 people, about 40,000 square foot of baking space.
Nice.
And we sold all over the United States, airlines like United Airlines and People Express and supermarkets and convenience stores and specialty stores and mail order. And it was all pre-internet, which I always like to say.
Yeah, now that sheds a whole new set of light on
Oh, my goodness.
All sorts of kind of light on that.
And at the time, so we sold the business in 1989 to a company here in North Carolina in Raleigh called Goodmark Foods. And Goodmark Foods... and the CEO was a man named Ron Doggett, who bought the business, and they owned the Slim Jim brand.
Oh, I see.
And the Jesse Jones meat snack brand, packaged meats brand. And so they also had some bakery businesses that I came and was involved and managed. And worked my way up the chain and was VP of marketing for the company and stayed with them through 19... Well, let's see, we were sold to Conagra Foods.
Oh.
Which is the $29 billion Goliath, one of the five biggest food companies in the world. They acquired the business, and I stayed with them through about 2005. So most of my background is really food and beverage marketing and consumer marketing focus mostly.
So you've been able to succeed because you've had great products to promote, but also because you have a really interesting approach to marketing. You have a real personal approach to marketing, it seems to me, as I look around at some of the things you've done. Tell us about the book you've recently published.
About a year ago, I wanted to put down in words some of the experiences that I've had in marketing. So I wrote a book called Unraveling the Mysteries of Marketing, and in it I told stories about, well, one day we're sitting in our backyard and the phone rings, and it is the White House inviting my wife to sit on the dais with Ronald Reagan when he was coming to speak at the corporate park where we were located. So there's quite a story about having lunch with Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
We also got to make brownie ice cream with Ben and Jerry, Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield from Ben and Jerry's. So we had an amazing experience with the two of them and working with them, and it was just unbelievable opportunity. So we've had a lot of, you know, really unbelievable experiences. But the purpose of the book was really to share some of the life lessons of marketing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Ben Cohen as an example, I just didn't know that you couldn't pick up the phone and call somebody as well-known as that and that they wouldn't respond. I just was so naive as a 28, 29-year-old guy. But I also learned an important lesson about just being a human being and not trying to market to targets and segments and business. You market to people.
Right.
And I've always been and tried to be a good listener and to understand marketing issues and opportunities by hearing where those opportunities are, not necessarily talking, although I'm doing all the talking now.
That's okay. You're being interviewed. That's the way it's supposed to be. I do have to mention, however, that your book sits on our front entryway table, and my kids were home recently, and I think it was my son who picked up the book and said, this is kind of interesting, because he's a business major, you know. I said, yeah, it's a pretty interesting book. I said, guess who wrote it? He said, Jeff Slater. And I said, yeah, it's Fanny's dad. It's Fanny's dad? So we now have another set of celebrities in your life. I mean, not quite Ronald Reagan, but you started with Rachel's Brownies, and then your daughter ends up on Rachel Ray. How does this work?
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful way the universe works. So Fanny, who you met in Wilmington and mm-hmm. have done some work with, Fanny is a caterer and a blogger and writes for Focus on the Coast in Wilmington mm-hmm. And other publications, and she got a text in November from my mother, my 87-year-old mom, B, and the text said, I just saw on Rachel Ray they're having a Great American Cookbook Competition. You ought to submit for it. So the important part of that story is my mother's 87 and she's texting
right,
her
exactly.
granddaughter on
exactly.
an iPhone. But beyond that, she Fanny said, okay, I'll try that, and she sent in her recipes and her ideas, and her idea was Taste Like Childhood, and memories from cooking together with me as a kid, and my wife inspiring her through her love of natural foods and organic foods. Well, lo and behold, she made it to the finals, and then the final 4, 3, 2, and she won. So she has a contract with Atria to publish her cookbook, her first cookbook, which will be out sometime next year, and you know, it's incredibly satisfying when you have business successes, but to see your child successful.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
Well, she definitely had someone in her life guiding her that whole time, so the story is a pretty cool one.
She had two guides. She had her mom with her steady hand on her back mm-hmm. and me saying, come on, come on, come on. So it's that combination of the brake and the accelerator together.
Yeah, it's very cool.
But it is cool.
We're going to switch gears here for just a second. We're going to talk about high tech. We're going to talk about nanotechnology for a minute here with Miles Wright. Miles, welcome again.
It is good to be here. I really, after listening to Jeff, I should have gone first because he's got a great story to tell.
He does, as do you, however. So here's this guy. So anybody who's listening doesn't know anything about Sanofi. This organization is... I mentioned the other day, I was at a cocktail party. Check it out. Anne's actually at a cocktail party in Wilmington. And this person was there who's finishing his master's at NC State and studying something to do with chemistry, this, that, or the other thing. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm having somebody from Sanofi. And they're like the hottest thing. They are the hottest thing. And I said, oh, well, they are. Can you tell me what they do? And he said, and he went into a long explanation. So I'm going to ask you to tell everybody what Sanofi does, a little bit less technically, perhaps, than this person did.
Okay. Well, that's mighty gracious of whoever that was. We basically have a way of using liquids to produce nanomaterials. And these are just incredibly small, typically fibers, but not always. They might be little spheres or different shaped objects. And what's cool about these materials is that they can be put into a lot of different products and used a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. And without getting too far into the technical side, we have projects right now where we're working on food additives. We have a project right now where we're working to remove radioactive isotopes out of nuclear wastewater.
Wow.
We've got a project where we're working on some filtration things. We've got a project around wastewater treatment and growing microbes on nanofibers to remove nitrogens and organophosphates out of wastewater. So these materials can cut a pretty wide swath of applications.
How big do you have to be considered nano?
It depends who you ask. There's some active debate. If you look
at the science world, never any debate in the science world.
I know. We just we sit around and sing kumbaya all day. The strict definition is one of your dimensions has to be less than 100 nanometers. And to give you some sense of size, your average atomic, your average atom is usually a third to a half of a nanometer. A lot of proteins might be in the 60, 70, 80 nanometer range. So we're talking about incredibly small materials. We get compared to a human hair. And depending if you have thin hair like mine, it's probably about 50 to 60,000 nanometers. And so we're producing things that are, you know, 100 to 500 generally. So it gives you some sense. You can't see these with the naked eye.
And why? What is it about having something so small that makes it so, I don't know, what, versatile? Or?
I think for us, we focus on when you take a fiber and make it very small, what you've really done is you've created a tremendous amount of surface area for the mass that you have. So if you take a baseball or let's say just a round ball of steel, and you've got a certain amount of surface area. If I take that round ball of steel and hammered it into a big flat sheet, I've taken that same mass and greatly, greatly increased the surface area out of the exact same material. Now, if that surface area does something catalytic, or then it becomes a much more effective mechanism for doing whatever you're trying to do. If you attach peptide ligands onto that surface to remove, to create affinity attraction to proteins, it's just going to be a lot better at it than that round steel ball is, because you've got so much more surface area.
Tell us, go back a couple of few minutes ago, you talked about some of the applications that you're working on right now. Take one of those, if you wouldn't mind, and just explain what it is you're doing in that. I mean, how does nanotechnology play into that, and what physically is happening that you're working on?
Okay. Well, we just, last month, we released a 3D cell scaffold in Tokyo, and we're going to be launching it here in the States at the Bio International show in San Diego later this this month. But one of the things I think in the world of cell culturing is that for a long time, scientists and researchers grew cells on glass plates and polystyrene plates and basically flat surfaces. And what we've seen in the last 10 to 20 years is that cells adapt to that two-dimensional growth platform. And it doesn't really mimic what happens in your body very well. And so when you start creating nonwovens and different materials to grow cells three-dimensionally, it really mimics, and cells react differently on in a three-dimensional structure than if you just grow them on a glass plate. Now, what we found through the years, the last few years, is that having really small fibers creates a biomimic to your extracellular matrix. You can't use big materials. It has to be very fine, and it's almost like this chaotic architecture. It's hard to describe over the radio what that looks like, but so what we've learned is that nanofibers are actually a really good biomimic for this cellular matrix that's in your body. And so we make a material that mimics that, and the nanofibers, because of the high surface area and the more the shape of the mats that we put them in, it really accelerates growth and mimics more what goes on in your body, whether it's for cancer cell work or stem cell work. Or
so this has a lot of different kinds of applications then inside the body.
It does.
If you will. Wow.
Regenerative medicine applications, you know, that gets into a lot of different
cutting-edge
areas.
That's really cool. So if Zebulon's now the wine center of the world, is Raleigh becoming the nanotechnology center of the world?
I would love to say that's true, but I don't think we're quite there yet. I think nanotechnology in general, there's some buzz, and you see some, it really takes me back to the early 80s when I was at a conference one time, and I stood in front of a bunch of people and with a straight face said, by 1990, we're going to be paperless society. And people didn't laugh. People nodded their heads yes. Because at that time, there was this crazy early exuberant mentality around the notion of microcomputers and the advent of personal computers. And we didn't really, and I think, you know, the notion of paperless society is now still silly, but it just took us longer to get there. And we, in that industry, had to go solve real world problems, like y'all solved one in the cork business.
Yeah.
And so nanotechnology, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I need to go out and get some nanotechnology. They say, I want to go get a good cup of coffee, and the filter used in that might be have nanofibers in that, because it has some way of pulling certain bitter abstracts out of the coffee grinds or something.
Yeah.
So it's always going to be a helper technology that's kind of a little behind the scenes and a little more interesting, mm-hmm. probably to scientists than the average consumer.
And what is it that you guys do differently than some of your competitors?
There are, before we came along, there are basically two ways of making nanofibers. Both of them were dry process, and both of them produce long, continuous fibers. We've come along with a way of forming nanomaterials in liquid shear. So we do this completely in liquids, and the difference for us is that our nanofibers, we can control the length of them. So
okay.
That ability to control the length dictates how we integrate into existing manufacturing on products.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have a application right now we're trying to get to the market this year to create greater hydrophobicity in fluorochemicals. Okay, sorry. I take that back.
It wasn't on my spelling list for this week.
I tried to tone that back, but I know that sounded bad.
Okay, try it one more time. Let's see if we can all learn a new word.
It will greater hydrophobicity on for fluorochemicals. In other words, it repels water and oils better. Now, there's a movement moving the different types of chemistries that are allowed through the EPA and regulatory agencies. And we're moving towards safer products, but some of these products don't work as well.
Okay.
And so we make a tiny, tiny 35 micron long rod, if you will, a nano rod, that gets added into these products that essentially, without aggressive chemistries and with a natural polymer, makes the water repellency of materials increase by about 25%.
Mm, wow.
And you do it with a kind of a healthy product, and there's no aggressive chemistry around it.
Oh, that's really cool. Do you do a lot of work with NC State? You were entrepreneur in residence there. Are you, or were you?
I took this year off.
You're on vacation.
I hope they let me come back. Executive in residence.
Executive in residence,
yes.
Excuse me.
And so I've worked with the technology commercialization program over there for the past 6 years. I took this year off, but it's fun. You know, you get to watch a lot of technologies kind of bubble up out of the universities. We get a few from other sources, and we have student teams vet them out and try to make, you know, you might start with a pile of 50 technologies, some of them patented, some of them not, you know, different stages, and you vet them down to try to find those two or three opportunities that you can form a company around and launch.
Yeah, and what kind of challenges are they seeing?
You know, all the normal ones. Figuring out the IP landscape is always
A
challenge.
Yeah.
Seeing things in such an early stage that it's hard to know where that real commercial traction is going to be found.
Right.
And more often than not, what you think at first ends up not being right. And then
in terms of the product itself, the way the product goes, not necessarily the way you approach selling it or marketing it, but even just how you use
define
the product.
Until you get out into the real world and start talking to people and trying to solve real world problems, a lot of times, I mean, I think Nomacor is a good example where y'all had this extrusion or co-extrusion process, however y'all describe it. And after a little bit of time, you saw the cork business and they probably out of the gate, they didn't see the cork business.
Right.
And that happens with a lot of technologies, and you go out and talk to people.
Yeah. Are you finding better access to funding, do you know, these days?
No.
not better access to funding. It's still difficult.
Yeah, it's always difficult.
Yeah,
you know, because there's always going to be an economic Darwinism principle around raising funds, and it's not always based on the best science. It's not always based on a lot of it's based on people's track records.
Sure.
You know, if you have the exact same technology and you have a guy with maybe a couple of gray hairs versus a 18-year-old person trying to commercialize it, there's a lot of factors that go into it. But, items 1, 2, and 3 on the difficult challenge list for startups is funding, funding, and funding. That's the barrier. And it's particularly tough in North Carolina. As much activity, we have the hard part covered here. We have a lot of R&D spend. We have a lot of we have an amazing university system. We've got good R&D companies. What we don't have is the depth of funding to match the technology here.
I do have to say, CED came out with their report last week that identified there's nearly $500 million was invested last year. 2013 was a good year for North Carolina. Yeah. I think we had something like 12 or 13 IPOs, which, you know, we've had zero for so long that, well, I guess we had one the year before and two the year before that, but compared to 13, that's next to nothing. And quite frankly, we're seeing a whole lot of uptick in terms of outside money coming into North Carolina.
Well,
so
it's great to see the IPO market, but the markets that I'm talking about are really the early and seed stage companies. By the time you get to an IPO level,
or even VC is probably down the road for them.
There's a lot of money that's raised in that. So of that, you know, I didn't see the report, $500 million.
I'll have to share that with you.
Whatever that number is. I tend to think about and work with companies that are in the 0 to 25-50 employee range. And I can tell you that number's not $500 million. It's, and it's great. You know, I love the big headlines, but, you know, particularly in that startup realm, resources are very, very hard to come by.
Very early stage.
So, you know, you said earlier, very few people wake up in the morning and say, gee, I got to go get myself some nanotechnology. But help our listeners, you know, understand just how prevalent is nanotechnology in everything that we do in the course of a day, all the products that we use. You know, we all get up, we sort of go through the same routine. We go to work, we use products, we go home. How prevalent is it, even though we don't really know it's there?
It's all around us. And we've now kind of coined this term nanotechnology. We talk about it as if it's a definable thing.
Yes.
If you go back to the great cathedrals in Europe, they used different oxides to stain glass. And that was essentially a nanotechnology that they were using back then. Needless to say, back in the 1600s, 1700s, nobody talked about nanotechnology. And we didn't think about it that way. But that's exactly what was going on, because these oxides were down on the nanoscale. We see it, it's all through drugstores, from wound care to suntan lotions to the actual biopharma.
Yeah.
Applications. We see it in air filtration. We see it in liquid filtration.
Sure. So it's in your coffee filters, and it's in your car air filters, and it's pretty much everything you touch from the minute you get out of bed. Maybe your sheets.
There are food additives that go through a nanotechnology stage where they have a very high surface area, and they get mixed in. You have starches and things like that. So it's extremely prevalent, but we don't really talk about it that way, because we talk about the final product.
You know, one of the lessons from company that I've been working at now for the last 5 years, Nomacork, everybody who works in our company is in the wine industry. Now, we have 6 PhDs, we have, you know, salespeople, we have business people, we have finance people, but our heads are all around one vertical market, and we're all focused in that. And it makes such a difference, because we can day in and day out be thinking about that business and the needs. Because when I'm hearing you talk, I'm thinking, well, there are all these filtration issues for wine. You know, when wine is made and they have to filter, and filter, and there's all kinds of micro oxygenation processes and ways of managing oxygen and measuring it. And I wonder about that type of technology in an industry like the wine business or beverage in general.
Yeah, what you see right now, we've actually done some prototype depth filtration units for beer and other food products of increasing the flow through the filter, but also increasing the things like turbidity reduction within the liquid. So it's happening around you. I guarantee whoever's making your filtration substrates and all, if they're not using nanotechnology, their R&D folks are looking at it. It's not just about small fibers. It's about making them catalytic in somehow so that they can target different materials to either include or exclude from a filtration process.
So, Miles, who are your real customers? Who are the folks that you try to get to tell them about what you're doing and you know, try to find an application for your technology?
Our current customers are a pretty broad swath of large, you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies. We have probably one of the five largest chemical companies in the world that we do a lot of work with. We do some work with a giant Japanese consumer electronics company. I have agreements, so I'm not supposed to say.
We understand.
But it's their R&D people, I assume, that mostly talk to you.
Right. We usually start with the scientist, and then if it starts getting interesting, then the business people come in, and then there's a whole due diligence vetting process to start getting toward an actual product. We deal with one of the probably two or three largest food companies in the world. We work with companies across the spectrum, but it's usually companies that have a pretty active R&D program. Mm-hmm. Not to be disrespectful to anybody, but you know, most all billion, 10, 50 billion dollar companies all say they want to innovate. And you know, most applications these days are pretty complicated, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to, it's a process of cross-pollinating ideas and worlds to figure out new things. Y'all work in the wine industry, and if you take those scientists and those people that are very versed in that and put them in a room with 12 other disciplines, you're going to have some good ideas come out of it. And so that's what we do. We try to get in conversations with people that aren't in our skill set. We don't really go to nanotechnology conferences for that very reason. Mm-hmm. We go to biopharma conferences. We go to wastewater treatment conferences, which aren't that much fun.
I was going to say, I'd rather go to the wine conference.
I know. I think Jeff is having a lot more fun than I am.
Well, from Slim Jims to the wine business, it's a big jump, let me tell you.
Sounds like the good life to me.
It is. No, I count my blessings every day. It's a great company. And actually, one of the things I love so much about it is, of course, you know, there is wonderful wine to drink, but you know, you get to really meet some incredible people. I had the honor about 6 weeks ago to have Stephanie Gallo, who is the granddaughter of Ernest Gallo, speak at a conference that Nomacork has created for the marketing folks in the wine business. And she was talking about the democratization of wine coming from her grandfather to her today. And it was just incredible being part of that kind of experience. So it's really a lot of fun to be at that level. On the other hand, we are really a technology company, and we have some incredible scientists who do amazing stuff around measurement of oxygen in wine through really innovative ways in which technologies can support the industry. So it's all in service to the industry, and we come at it from a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. So Jeff, I must admit, I'm not a wine connoisseur. I drink wine. When I open a bottle, I either like it or I don't like it. If I like it, I try to remember what it is, I go buy another one. But what's the possibility that consumers will actually sort of start demanding that their wine is corked with your product, or that sort of the flip side of that, that the wine companies will, you know, sort of begin to say in their advertising, raw wine is better because we use normal cork.
Hmm. That's a great question. Well, the consumer really in their decision tree of why they buy wine, usually it starts with price, occasion, is it red or white, is it a brand I know, what's, you know, the different things. And the type of packaging and closure is very low on that decision tree. And that's true in the United States, it's true in Brazil, it's true in France, it's true in Italy. It's just not, people want to drink wine, they don't really want to talk about packaging per se.
Right.
But we do have a point of difference and a quality that we can deliver. So most of our communication continues to be with the trade. Having been in a consumer marketing business and knowing the tens of millions of dollars required to move a needle, it's a very expensive proposition. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure necessarily the right place for us to put money. But we are finding wines who are now using products. Like, for example, we have a brand new product that we've just introduced this past year. And instead of being made with fossil fuel oil to create a polymer, it's now made with sugarcane, non-GMO sugarcane that's grown in Brazil. You know, we can close 1 million bottles of wine with the sugarcane grown on a football field, or I should say a soccer field, to be accurate. So it is a completely revolutionary way, and it's just a way that we have to keep innovating and challenging ourselves and finding new ways of using materials responsibly.
So I guess indirectly, the consumers could influence the use of your product, because if the wine tastes better and they buy more of it and it's
exactly
closed with your product, then your customers are likely to buy more of it and use more of it, and that will
exactly
sort of increase the demand for it. But I mean, you're absolutely right. Quite frankly, before this morning, I didn't really realize that there were choices about how my wine was closed.
Yeah, I like to talk about
it. I didn't really expect it.
Yeah, I talk about it. I wrote a blog about this called the shoelace paradox. What brand of shoelace do you have in your sneaker? You probably never think about it. But if it breaks and then you go buy another pair of those laces and it breaks again, you're going to suddenly, for about 7 seconds, be focused on shoelaces. I mean, we're talking about cars before. I don't even know what kind of brakes I have in my car, and they protect my family.
Right.
So it's just not a high level of engagement category where people care. But if they get great wine, they're happy, they buy it again.
Well, the differentiation point is either screw top or enclosed with something.
Right.
And historically, the screw top, you know, it dwelled down there on the Thunderbirds of the world. And now we actually see much better wines going to screw tops. And I think, you know, y'all have driven this revolution out there. And at least to the people I know and talk to, and of course, knowing your company, there's no negative pushback at all. In fact, if anything, it's just a positive that we're not taking down trees to do this.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of supporters globally, big companies who use our closures. And I think because we successfully provide them with technology, you know, sort of bring this back to the technology story, that's really what it's about. We can provide them with ways to make their wine better through not only the closure, but all the things that we can do.
That's great. Well, this has been a really fun show. Jeff, how can people get in contact with you if they want to learn more?
NomaCork.com is the company website, and that has all sorts of wonderful information on it about us. And
could you spell that out, please?
Sure. It's NomaCork.com.
Very good.
And that's the best place to find information about the company.
Super deal. And Miles, how about you guys?
Xanify.com. If you go to Xanify.com, you will notice that we are in search for somebody to help us with our website. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but
So in other words, we'll see a new one pretty soon.
With any luck.
And for the listening audience, how do you spell Xanify?
Xanofi.
Love those things that have an X in them. Maybe, like Business Radio X.
Maybe we should ask. Maybe we should ask, how did you get that name?
Well, I'll say this. Nanotechnology is kind of easy compared to naming a company. It's at least you can go to school and learn some of the basics. So we were in a conference room. We started with Nano. We felt like Nano was overplayed. When you start talking to insurance agents, they don't like to hear Nano. We're sub-micron fibers to those guys. And so the notion of scalability came into play, because that's a huge issue for nanotechnologies. And so we took X as a mathematical universal for scalability, put it on the front. So then we became Xano. We suffered many Xanadu and Olivia Newton-John jokes through the process. And since we made fibers, we put FI on the end, so Xanify.
Excellent.
You know, that's great advice right there for folks who are trying to name a company.
Well, and
that's probably some of the best information we got all morning for our listeners right there.
I wrote a little software thing where I've used in the past, where we just put down all the primitives. We brainstorm, take a whiteboard, and just whatever comes to your mind. You write up 200 words. And it's just free association. Then you start putting those words together in interesting ways. And if you do that, you will find a combination that it might not be the right one, but, and that's kind of what we did. Now we through all that process, we managed to come up with a name that nobody can actually say properly. So,
nothing's perfect. Zanofi.
Zanofi.
Zanofi. I bet you do. Sure. It's like my last name. Well, you guys, I really thank you for being in the studio. We learned a lot today about two really important companies in the region, and we thank you for your time. And I want to thank Cal for joining us today. And we will be back again tomorrow with Carolina Connections, and we'll be back in the studio with Metro Raleigh Business Radio next Monday. And until then, this is Anne Ravel-Petcher for Business Radio X.